Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 175 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the second amount of podcast that's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me, well, not as always, we don't have Aaron Paulette. Aaron Paulette is not with us, but instead, we have the Egghead. How you doing, Egghead?
I'm doing fine, despite the abrupt record scratch as we derailed the usual intro.
Yeah, actually, I forget to ask how we start, because I've done a bunch of other podcasts. You're on Handgun Radio with us and all that. Should I address you as just the Egghead? Can I use your Christian name?
Oh God, I don't have a Christian name. I can be Jake. That's fine. I was Egghead for a while because I was trying to preserve anonymity, but I mean, like, there's a million and a half Jakes.
There's a lot of them. It's like David. David's super big on OPSEC, but it's one of those, like, a Jew from New York named David. The deuce, you say? I'll figure him out pretty quick. Oh, so yeah, I will just start off with just a lead off is that, yeah, Aaron's not doing super well. Her physical health is fine. She is just emotionally exhausted and tired from a large number of events and episodes that have gone on. And last week she essentially just pretty much just before the show, she was like, I can't do it. I need to sit this one out. And I'm like, okay. And David and Oddball quickly popped in and away we went with the show. And I hopefully it was, it definitely felt different to me, but hopefully you guys enjoyed it well enough. And then we talked afterwards and she's just in a really, really bad headspace and she kind of needs to clear some space. And I told her, look, I'm like, are you just quitting the show? She's like, no, if I was quitting the show, I'd tell you I was quitting the show. So that rumor has been floated around and that is not the case. Instead she's just taking a little bit of time off for herself. And I said, look, take some time to clear your head. We don't want to force anybody onto the show. And I definitely, if it will help you feel better just to not have this, you know, as something that you have to do every week. And she agreed. So, you know, send some love out to Aaron. We miss you. You are here in spirit and, we will see you when you're feeling a little bit better. But of course we have Jake the Egghead because I said, you know what? We've been talking a bunch and you have been saying, oh man, I really need to do a segment and you haven't been finding your muse. And I'm like, you know what? I know a cool that actually reminds me of somebody. That reminds me of one Aaron Paulette, who is like, I don't want to be doing a segment every week. It's just too tiring. But I'm like, can you come on and talk? Yeah, I could do that. Cool. And so
yeah,
I said, hey Jake, come on. And he and here you are.
Yep. And y'all are stuck with me, good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah. So how have you been?
I've been doing pretty well. I got a new job recently, so that's been keeping me busy. But I am now working from home, which has the side benefit of I can just sit here on a conference call and nobody has to know that I have my Suppress 320 sitting at my desk because I can now. Concealed carry at work gets a hell of a lot easier when it's, you know, your bedroom and your home office.
Exactly. That's good times. And are you going into meetings sans culottes?
Not yet. I figure I'll give it a little bit just in case for some reason I need to get up and grab something or, you know, but I will probably eventually be like business professional from the nipples up and that's it.
Do the, they call it the Zoom mullet, which is your business casual from the waist up and you're wearing like cargo shorts or PJs from the waist down.
The Zoom mullet. I like it. I haven't heard that one
before. Yeah. Business in the front, party in the rear.
Oh, God. Well, no, that's when you got your assless chaps.
Exactly. Well, all chaps are assless.
Okay, yeah, you got me there.
If they had a butt in them, they'd be called pants.
That's true. Except leather pants.
Yes. But
well, those are a thing.
That's a thing. Oh, so yeah, I've had...
So that just, got weird fast.
Yeah, they got weird fast. And yeah, I've just had a crazy week. My daughter got more braces. She's had braces for about a year now, And it was fairly young. A lot of people, like, actually, literally, we were at her, we were at a, like a fall festival at her school. And one friend ran up to her and said, "Hey, my dad doesn't believe that you have braces. Can you come show him?"
Yeah. I mean, I didn't see her that long ago and she was, you know, knee high to a grasshopper. So how, like, she can't be that old.
No, she just turned 8. So yeah, it's my understanding that so long as there's enough teeth to adult teeth to stick the brackets to, you can actually do a whole lot more with the teeth earlier on. So it was recommended to us that she get the problems corrected earlier. And it doesn't help that she has aspirations to be a dentist. And I'll say right now, I when I was her age, I knew I was going to be a marine biologist. So I'm not doubting this. So she loves going to the dentist's office, like, so much, like, excited. But
I am envious of both of your certainties.
And you still haven't figured out what you want to be when you grow up.
I was going to be a fighter pilot at that age.
But yeah, she just got a whole bunch more brackets put on because the adult teeth that they've been watching have gotten big enough to work with, and it was causing her a lot of discomfort, which was affecting a lot of things. Let's just say there was an exceptionally grouchy girl in my house, and that led to a lot of extra stress in my life. But
tooth pain is nothing to trifle with.
No. So, but I think we're out of the woods now. I've been running around like crazy though. Speaking of tooth pain, I had to take my mother-in-law needed to go to the dentist, and she goes into Boston, and at Tufts Medical, Tufts Medical, to go to the dental school. Like, we've all heard that story. They do amazing work for not a lot of money. And so she was just like, she needed to get into the city. So I drove her in this morning and then had to go and pick her up. So I've just been running around like crazy all day. And so now it is time. I have got a flight of gimlets, and I'm sitting down with my buddy, and we're doing a podcast.
I've been promoted to buddy.
I
feel special.
You've been my buddy for a long time. You're cool dudes.
I'm just giving you sugar.
So yeah, with enough of the pleasantries, we have topics, and not only do we have the topic that I think we're all thinking about right now, we will get to that one, but also after listening to last week's podcast, Sean Sorrentino sent me this the news article that's in the show notes. And in fact, the Norwegian police have come forward to say that the spree killer that was at Norway did not kill at least all of his victims, or it sounds like actually didn't kill any of his victims with the bow and arrow. The bow and arrow was present, but it was a bladed weapon of some sort. In the linked article, there's someone mentioned something about a machete, but that's unconfirmed. You had the attack in England, and now the attack in Norway, both knife attacks. Oh, if only we had common sense knife control.
Yeah. I'm reminded of a picture of a Thomas the Tank Engine silverware set with a little ID on it that says, you know, must be 18 to purchase. And it should be a Babylon Bee article, but it's not.
That is real. A legit photograph. I'll see if I can dig that up for the show notes as well. It doesn't take much searching, but the literally Thomas the Tank Engine flatware set, and it says you need to show ID, and that's in England and a bunch of other places. And again, the first human tools were, the first one was a hammer, and then the second one was a knife.
Yep. And apparently this guy did have a ton of arrows and did shoot a lot of arrows, but I think it said he only injured one off-duty police officer with it, and all of the people killed were actually killed with the sharp object, as they're putting it. So it's possible they did mention a machete, maybe he had a knife too, who knows, but it was some sort of like small bladed weapon probably.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this and again, they are not changing. That was actually one thing that I was looking at is were they changing? Because when I first started reading it, I'm like, oh, was I also wrong on the amount of time that this guy was just on the loose? Nope. Still 45 minutes of complete unfettered time with society, and the police did encounter him first before he had killed anybody. All the victims were killed after first contact with police. So yeah,
it's just sad to see a society that just has no way of dealing with violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they had all of the methods that you have to contain a psychopath that don't involve trying to go like hand to hand in a quote unquote fair fight with a guy who's going to pick a fight with whoever he wants to. All of those methods are stripped away, even for the police. So you have your cops just kind of staring at this guy and being like, well, why don't you stop him? Well, no, why don't you stop him? And neither one of them wants to go because they don't have any edge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they literally probably don't have an edge. They probably don't even have a knife on them.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like they retrieved guns pretty quickly. I don't know if that means that they have guns in the squad car or what the story was with that. I'm not really interested in digging through it, but
is 45 minutes pretty quickly, or did they literally stand there with guns and like not do anything to stop this guy for a while?
If I remember correctly from, and now I have to dig back to other stories besides the one that was in like last week's show, but it's my understanding that the cops found the guy, engaged him, he shot arrows at them, they took cover, and then when they went to go make a move on him or flank him or whatever it was, he was gone, and they did not know where he went, and he had gone, it sounds like he'd gone into a private residence and was killing the occupant there. So
this is
just again the statement of you can't like legislate your way out of violence, but you can legislate people to have the ability to defend against violence. And that's really where I'm going for with just my general philosophy on firearms ownership is the go get educated and get the tools that seem best for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let us go on to the elephant in the room. And interestingly enough, I hadn't planned on this, but Xander threw a segment together. He's like, I need to rant about this. There's a segment up, and I'm like, okay. So I'm gonna let Xander be our introduction to the story. As you've all heard about it, on the set of the Western film Rust, actor Alec Baldwin accidentally shot and killed the director of photography and wounded the film director. And here is Xander. He's gonna lead us with this story.
Okay, this is a bit of a rant, and I'm a bit under the weather, so hopefully Weird can remove all my coughing and whatnot. Ugh, that wasn't even deliberate. Anyway, sorry, not sorry for Weird's ears. We're ear pro, dude, when listening to my segments and rants. Something, something, Xander is a sick bastard. Anyway, alright. Everybody's probably heard by now about Alec Baldwin screwing around with a gun on a movie set and presumably accidentally killing one person and injuring another. And that is awful. There's no better word for it. Whatever the guy thinks, I am giving the benefit and his opinion on guns. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt that no harm was intended, that he was confident that he was in a secure area with a firearm that had been established as completely and totally unloaded. And then I think, as Aaron put it a few weeks ago, asshole bullet fairies loaded it. Okay, first things first, lockout tagout rules. You lock something out, you establish it as having had all sources of energy disabled, and which includes gravity, electrical, hydraulic, pneumatic, that sort of thing. then you physically lock out each source with a lock that has a tag with your name on it, and you have the key. This creates a safe workspace to take care of the whatever needs to be done. And then, following procedures, you first verify that there are no other personnel in the area. Then you can remove the locks and reestablish the power sources. If off the top of my head, if I was to set up firearms for a movie shoot, I would go through and very thoroughly ensure that the guns would have no ammunition of any sort within them, and thoroughly tag them, as in things like chamber flags and zip ties, possibly to the extent of every revolver chamber, and also a zip tie through each magazine, on top of the aforementioned bullet flags, trigger locks, etc. Take them to the set and filming area, and anything that is brought in is tagged and verified, and nothing leaves, period, until the film is wrapped. Now, as I record this, it is word has gotten around that perhaps the gun in question was used for some plinking off the set in between takes and whatnot. And that is presumably how a bullet got left in, a round got left in a chamber. As fun as it is, some things you need to go the long way around for safety, period. In early film, they actually did film with live rounds, and there had been some famous actors who stopped and said, no, we're not doing this. And things changed and improved, possibly after people getting hurt and killed, and rinse, repeat. Again, this is a freaking safety thing. Just like with pyro and demolitions and similar, it must have been quite frightening to work on the Jaws or Jurassic Park sets with gigantic robotic creations, and having been in a tractor when suddenly a bulldozer blade hit something solid that was not going to move and being thrown around. The machines don't care. When you are no longer in control of a machine, you are at its complete unthinking mercy. And that includes misused machines. It is, the other thing is, again, early reporting and the caveats that go with, Baldwin was told that it was a Colt gun, and presumably the set armorer who tossed him the gun didn't double check. And that's another thing. You are handing someone a gun that is not supposed to be loaded. When you do so, you always check. You always check. You always check. This training should also be brought to the actors handling the firearms as well. It is not victim blaming. This is more seatbelt and belt and suspenders thinking. Yes, you are told that it is a safe gun. You are in an area where it is supposed to be a safe gun. You check the gun anyway. You verify that it is in the condition it is supposed to be, with the appropriate ammunition or lack thereof, such as blanks or dummy rounds, that sort of thing. Honestly, with computer graphics the way as good as they are now, It is a much cheaper life insurance insurance period to just simply digitally correct the head stamps. Look at the first Deadpool movie when the primers had the count of how many rounds that Deadpool was firing. That was so well done. And you can easily do that with in post-processing. So if you need to have the look of a real bullet, you can add that in. I do not want my entertainment to be at the expense of someone's life. And it, I feel sorry for the dude, really, and the people around him. And I am really, really unhappy with the folks who decided to use movie props for target practice. For goodness sakes, there's other sources of firearms. You can go rent guns at ranges, ask your friends to help loan a firearm or something like that. Oh, my goodness. Nothing good went into this, and I really hope something good comes out of it. Goodness. Try to have fun. Stay safe. I hope it gave you something to think about with this rant. Have a good one, guys.
So, where to start on this one? I mean, it's there's a lot of details in this that are just outlandish. I mean, Xander is completely right on just the level of negligence. Well, so first up, I'll lead this because there's a lot of people talking about, oh man, why would anybody even use live firearms on set? And honestly speaking, I think that's increasingly becoming less of a necessity than it has been in the past because of the ability to use CGI and get things, you know, so that it makes the guns look like they are functioning when they're in fact not. And actually, I put in the show notes, I just did a quick search on YouTube and found this dude that does, he's a teenager. It looks like, he looks like a kid. He might be in his 20s, but he's a young guy. And he does these little, independent student films and there's a lot of gunplay in them. And you look, it's clearly like they're airsoft guns. These guns are made out of plastic. And, you know, he's got a Colt Python replica. And you can clearly see that it's not loaded with ammo. And but boy, it looks pretty darn good. And this is just some kid on YouTube. This is not like, and he's not a prodigy. As a matter of fact, I remember some friends of mine in college did a student film where they were just using like squirt guns and stuff and putting in the muzzle flashes, and they didn't look bad.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, this is a Western, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there is no reason that they should need any kind of live ammunition for this, because you can take an actual revolver, mm-hmm. weld the barrel shut and shoot blanks, mm-hmm. and it will function exactly the same. Like, you don't have to cycle any actions. Everything is going to be actuated by cocking the hammer or running a lever. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why they didn't have basically a starter pistol, more or less, that just looked like a 357 or a 38 special cowboy gun, you know? Mm-hmm. And they had a real firearm on set. They had real ammunition on set. And they did not do well. My first reaction to this was I felt sorry for Alec Baldwin. Be like, well, gosh, he just doesn't know any better. And then the more I think about it, the more I start to get mad, because it's just a cascading series of failures where nobody in the room nobody in the room thought to say anything about it, except for the fact that just the day before, a bunch of people had walked off the set. Like, that's what really made me think that this was less of a tragic accident and more of a somebody needs to get sued for negligence, if not put in jail.
Yeah. I think jail time is going to happen. I mean, the more you read about this, the more, like you said, nesting amounts of like malfeasance, because what I was just going to lead with is that even though movie sets do use actual live firearms, and in the case of revolvers specifically, or any sort of manually operated gun, pump action shotguns, lever action rifles, revolvers, all of them that do not require any action to be cycled, you can use an entirely unmodified gun on the set, and it'll perform just fine for shooting blanks, for doing hero shots and all of that, versus semi-autos, which usually will need to be modified in some way so that they'll cycle when firing blanks. But all that being said, I can only think of now three deaths on a movie set in recent history. Might be some stuff from back in the golden age of Westerns and all that, but the best thing, the one I can hear that think about is, in 1984, a gentleman named John Eric Hexum, he was essentially waiting for them to reset a scene, the set of Cover Up, which was a television show that I actually hadn't even heard of. And he had a 44 Magnum Smith & Wesson revolver. I don't know if it was a 29 or a 6.29, but he had a Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum with him. And some accounts say that he was joking around. Some accounts say that they were bored and were playing a game of Russian roulette with the gun. And all of them assuming that because it was blanks and there were not bullets in it, the gun was not dangerous. And he ended up putting this gun to his own head and pulled the trigger, and the muzzle blast from a 44 Magnum blank is sufficient enough to crack his skull and drive the bone into his brain, and it killed him pretty much instantly.
Yeah, it's like the degree of kind of cavalier disregard for safety, and I think it says something about people who don't have any respect for firearms. Like, if you grow up around guns, if you know how to handle them, you would never do something like that.
Yeah.
But if you live in a world where only bad people have guns, but now I'm in a movie and I don't have to know anything about them, I don't need to learn anything about the dirty, evil gun, I have people to do it for me. Like, I'm going to make a weird connection here, but Mike Rowe, of Dirty Jobs, mm-hmm. has a phrase, safety third, right? Because he got tired of hearing people say safety first, because first off, it's not true. If safety was the number one priority, nobody would ever leave their home, right? No work would ever get done. He would joke about how, you know, they tell him safety first right before they have him, like, you know, climb into some little bosun seat and get hoisted up the side of a skyscraper to wipe the windows. If safety was first, you'd never do that. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, when you have that attitude, you put accountability for your safety on somebody else, because then it's not your job to be safe and to be reasonable and to be careful. It's the job of the OSHA guy to make sure your workplace is safe so that you can't hurt yourself. There's this concept he talks about called risk compensation, where they found out that on traffic crossings with pedestrian signals that allow people to cross when the light are green are sometimes more dangerous than the same intersection without a traffic signal, because people see the traffic signal that says you're okay to walk and they just walk. They don't think about it. Mm-hmm. And they don't look both ways and say, you know, that car doesn't seem to be stopping. Whereas if there's no walk symbol, if there's just a crosswalk, the cars are still supposed to stop. But you don't have that false sense of security that someone else is telling you it's okay. Somebody else has taken responsibility for your safety. So I think that is probably one of the in addition to just disgusting amounts of negligence, mm-hmm. On the part of the people who were actually supposed to be the professionals in the room, who are now nowhere to be found. Big surprise. I'd be hiding too. In addition to that, there's the sense that guns are bad, except in certain scenarios, and I'm special. And now because this isn't real life, this is a movie, I don't have to treat these things seriously because somebody else is going to just take care of it for me. I guess what I'm getting at is it's that same kind of just let the help handle it mindset that has people say things like, well, just call the police if there's a problem. You know, well, the police can't guarantee your safety any more than the OSHA guy can guarantee your safety when the dude driving a forklift isn't paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only person that can really, the person who can do the most is going to be you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was kind of a long-winded rant, but it kind of got my hackles up.
Yeah. I totally see that. But yeah, the other major death was Brandon Lee, which it's not confirmed, but from everything I've read, I believe that the dummy rounds that they used for the hero shot of the gun to make it appear like it was loaded were live rounds that had just simply had the powder dumped out, but they did not get rid of the primers. And so when the primers were so at some point a primer got hit and the barrel got squibbed, and then a blank round was put behind that squibbed barrel, and that pushed the round out at what would be muzzle velocity and killed Brandon Lee. And that one, they actually changed it so that now it was people wouldn't even, first you had it so that, like, all right, you don't let people handle the prop weapons when there's no reason for them to have it. If there's no reason for you to have a gun on set, then there's no guns on set. It's just eliminate that variability. Same reason with this whole statement of the, you know, stop touching your gun when you concealed carry. You don't draw your gun. You don't pull your gun out to show somebody or all that. The gun goes in the holster and stays in the holster. And unless you need to defend your life or you're putting it away at the end of the day, it doesn't come out of the holster. And then also on this set, they made it a point to make it so that when you're pointing a blank firing gun at an actor, quote unquote, at an actor, they would use forced perspective to make sure that the gun was pointed in a safe direction and it just looked like it was pointed at the actor. So that was another safety issue that came from the death of Brandon Lee. In this case, like you said, you were talking about the live ammunition got into the gun. All reports now are saying that the crew in the time off were taking the prop guns out into the desert and target shooting with them, which is all well and good unless you are not extremely cautious about where the live ammo goes and all that. And I would assume that this gun, which I've seen a lot of stuff, and I think it's a fair bet to say is a Colt Peacemaker of some sort, a single action army.
Yeah, I'd bet.
It was referred in one article that I've got listed as a vintage Colt, and the Alec Baldwin was playing essentially the hero of this movie. The character, the movie's called Rust. His character's name is Rust. And so as a general rule, the hero carries a single action army, 9 times out of 10. So this gun got brought back to set and it still had ammo that was being used for target practice in it, which is a big no-no. Furthermore, the assistant director was the person who supplied Alec Baldwin the gun when he requested doing a dress rehearsal of the scene. He told Alec Baldwin that the gun was cold, but he did not check if the gun was cold. And then Alec Baldwin simply took the gun and put it in his holster rather than checking to see it was. And
because again, the fault for checking if the gun is unloaded is on the prop master.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all safe.
Yeah.
Because surely there would never be something so extremely negligent as people using a actual live gun on set, one. Mm-hmm. Two, taking it off of set in off time and doing target practice with it. And three, putting it back without making sure it's unloaded. And four, not having the prop master verify the status of any potentially lethal weapon before just leaving it laying around ready to be used. The other thing this reminds me of is warnings unheeded. By Andy Brown, which I don't know if it's been discussed on the show before, but he did this great book on these twin incidents at Fairchild Air Force Base that happened a couple weeks apart. One was a mass shooting, and the other was a airplane crash practicing for an air show. And in both cases, there's a temptation to say, oh, it just came out of nowhere. We could have never predicted. But in both cases, and in most cases of crazy disasters, he's arguing, there's a long string of warnings and signs and indications and opportunities for people to step in and stop something, but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just thinking there have to have been people in that room. Well, there were clearly a lot of people in the room who were unhappy with the way that they were handling safety with firearms, because they literally walked out in strike not hours before this happened. And I wonder if as soon as they left, things were so they were probably having harsh words over the whole thing, and everyone was getting upset and people were getting very heated. I wonder if there was a certain sense of, well, we'll show them. And now we're going to be extra cavalier about it. And we're going to be, you know, all these dumb safety rules. We don't need to worry about them now that they're gone. And I wonder if that might have contributed to this disaster.
I don't know. I mean, it's there's just so many levels of problems. I mean, I think a big thing, and I'd love to see this change. I don't know if it's going to, the whole idea that, oh, it's the prop master's job to keep me safe. When I looked it up on IMFDB, the first entry for Alec Baldwin is The Hunt for Red October in 1990. And then really much of this, you know, you know about him as like a comedy actor. His first major film role was Beetlejuice, which, oh God, I mean, I have problems with Alec Baldwin as a person. He is stridently anti-gun and has done a whole bunch of things that I do not appreciate that he did. All that. I don't much care for him as a person, but I'm really a huge fan of him as an actor. He's really done an amazing body of work. But a lot of his early stuff in the 90s were action movies. And you've got to imagine that he had safety briefs then. This movie Rust was extremely low budget. It had a very, very small crew. It had a very, very small budget. So the fact that the assistant director was handling firearms and distributing them out instead of the armorer is, I don't know how unusual or all that, but the idea that the armorer might have been busy and tied up with other things at the time, and so therefore somebody else could take it up, doesn't seem like it's out of the realm of possibility.
Well, I guess, and that brings up a good point, is I kind of forgot to mention, in case anyone didn't know, that Alec Baldwin has been outspoken in being anti-gun before. And mm-hmm. I think it's tempting for me to say this, and I feel like it's valid, that I believe that if this were in an environment where most of these people were not anti-gun, I'm wagering most of these people are anti-gun. They don't like guns,
mm-hmm.
and therefore they never knew how to handle them, and they never treated them. They never learned how to be safe around them. Some of the people that you hand them a firearm that you've just cleared that are unloaded, and you've taught them the safety rules, and the first people to like flag people and just point it around casually are the people who are like, oh no, I hate guns. People shouldn't have guns. And then as soon as you are talking to them and you demonstrate and you unload and you hand it to them, they're sitting there pointing it straight at you casually.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm like, well, maybe you shouldn't have guns, but that doesn't necessarily say anything about the rest of us. But it's just, if any one of those people had been a moderately proficient, even casually safe gun owner, the first thing you do before you're going to do even dry fire in your own home
mm-hmm.
is you check the firearm, and you double check the firearm, and you triple check the firearm. Like I look like a nut job when I'm getting ready to do my dry fire, because I've done like 47 press checks and I've checked the chamber 3 times before I dry fire, you know? And it just blows my mind that somebody who can be so ostensibly afraid of the terrible danger that guns pose is not going to do the first safety check before pointing what they know to be a functional firearm at another human being and pulling the trigger.
Mm.
Although it does sound like he was in the middle of a quick draw practice, so it's possible that it went off accidentally while drawing. But in either case, if you're going to be handling a firearm, you need to be doing a safety check. And clearly, nobody in the chain of custody from that firearm, from the cart where it was sitting into Alec Baldwin's hands, was enough of an educated gun owner or gun user to do the first most basic safety check that everybody learns how to do as soon as anybody hands them a firearm for the first time.
Yeah. You mentioned about the doing. Yeah, this was not done in actual filming. This was done in, it was essentially a dress rehearsal before they started shooting. And he was allegedly practicing a draw technique with his prop firearm. And of course they say prop firearm doesn't necessarily mean it is some sort of altered firearm or not a real firearm. It's just a firearm that is a prop. And I wonder, because it is a Western and it was likely a single action army that he was using. One of the things that you always see in Hollywood quick draw is the gun comes out and comes to full cock, and to then return it back, you would need to thumb the hammer back down. And I've always talked about how I've got a CZ-82, which is a double action, single action gun. But it has a similar safety setup as the CZ-75 and CZ-75B, where you can carry it cocked and locked like a 1911, but the safety blocks the hammer from falling. So if the hammer is in the down position, the safety will not go on. And so if you are, and it doesn't have a decocker. So if I was going to carry it in double, for the first round is double action, you would need to chamber around and then thumb the hammer down. And in the case of a personal firearm, you're going to be rechambering around, on a somewhat regular basis for carry. And furthermore, I always do a press check before I put a gun in the holster. And so you would pull the hammer back for that. And then suddenly you would have to lower the hammer again. I've always said, if that was my carry gun, I would have a bucket of sand right next to the gun safe, so that I just point the gun at that as I'm dropping it down. Because if your finger flips off the trigger, instead of it bouncing off of a concrete floor, or God forbid you have it pointed in a not safe direction, instead have it pointed at a barrel of sand so that it will catch that bullet.
Yeah. If your thumb slips one out of every 1,000 times, you'll do it every 3 years,
But that, again, and that's a great point, is that, look, the checking to see if when the person says the gun's cold, it's not, check to see if the gun is cold. When they say it's cold, it's probably cold. But why wouldn't you just check it? It takes 3 seconds, and Alec Baldwin killed somebody. He didn't mean to. It was an accident. It sounds like he's not being charged. I have a little bit of conflict on that, because again, how many times, I don't know if you've ever had it, but there's been a couple of times where I've been handed an unloaded gun and I've cleared it and, oh, there's a round in the chamber. Oops, I forgot about that.
Yeah, as far as Baldwin goes, I think he's clearly really torn up about it. He was really distraught at the time. I'm sure he's still really distraught now. I'm upset with him because of the way that this happened. Not that I have any real connection to the guy, obviously. But I don't necessarily think he needs to be charged because he's the actor. I mean, I believe that he has a moral responsibility and an ethical responsibility to be accountable for the safety of himself and the people around him as much as he is able. But I don't necessarily think that should extend to like a legal responsibility. Although I would say the prop master, yeah, for sure. That is your job, to prevent this kind of thing from happening. So it's like someone needs to go to jail for this. This has got to be culpable negligence. I'm not a lawyer, but this smells really bad to me.
Yeah. And who is a lawyer is the widower of the director of photography who was killed.
Yeah. Well, let's just, do you want to put a bow on this? I feel like this horse we could beat to death for the next 3 weeks, because there's just so much crap. But
yeah, I want to just mention one more thing, only because this blew my mind. Granted, I am a super duper gun nerd, and so therefore this may not the validity of this may not hit everybody, but the armorer on set, it was just one woman. She's 24 years old, and her name is Hannah Gutierrez Reed. And I say Reed with a certain amount of gravity because she is the daughter of Thel Reed, which may not mean much to most people. He's kind of a super obscure person. I mean, finding photographs of him is hard to do. There's a couple of videos of him. Like, I think he was on the Ed Sullivan Show in like the 50s, but he grew up in California, and he was a quick draw artist. And in the mid 50s, he started consulting firearms handling and stuff for became the set armor for the TV show Gunsmoke, and has since become an absolute legend in set armor, specifically for Westerns, where he will both handle and curate the firearms used by the various characters, but he will also teach actors how to draw and fire their firearms, especially if they're looking for a quick draw type skill for it. And so this guy is a legend, and the fact that he started in the 50s, I've got to imagine that a lot of the like standard safety rules that an on-set armorer does were probably written and developed by Thel Reed, because also Thel Reed was very, very close friends and worked very, very closely with Jeff Cooper, both in the, you know, the guy who wrote the four rules of gun safety, and also Thel was one of the early instructors for guns. I believe he was instructor for Gunsight Academy, but he was definitely there for the founding of Gunsight Academy. So this lineage is, I mean, just quite amazing, and it's just so avoidable. It is so avoidable. And this is one of those, again, I've said this multiple times on the show, and I can't say it enough. We need to be teaching gun safety in public schools. Elementary school students should know the Eddie Eagle rules of stop, don't touch, leave the area, find an adult. Doesn't necessarily have to be the NRA, you know, copyrighted exact safety, but the idea that guns are something to be respected, guns are something not to be played with, and you're to find an adult if you find a gun. And then in middle school, everybody should learn the four rules of gun safety, how to safely handle a firearm, and how to identify the various kinds of firearms. This doesn't even necessarily need at this point does a live firearm need to be done. This can entirely be done with pictures and replicas and things like that. And then high school, I think everyone should qualify on handgun, rifle, shotgun. Doesn't even have to be anything special, you know, shoot a target with a 22 pistol, shoot a target with a 22 rifle, you know, bust a clay with a 20 gauge shotgun. I mean, just something as simple as that. So just those basic skills are there so that either A, fast forward and you are on the set of a movie and somebody hands you a gun and they say cold gun, you might have a pretty good idea of I should probably look to make sure that this is loaded, because, you know, say what you will about where the fault lies, Alec Baldwin killed somebody. Alec Baldwin has to deal with that for the rest of his life. Whether he's at fault for that or not, he did it. And you know, or in the simple thing of I'm over at a friend's house and we find, you know, his dad's gun, or we're older and I'm, you know, over at a friend's house and they have guns and they want to show you a firearm, and you would realize if they're doing that in an unsafe way. Hey, let me show you this shotgun I bought. Hey, can you open the action? Let's make sure that's unloaded.
Yeah. This whole thing just stinks of, it just stinks of Hollywood to me. Mm-hmm. It's like you have this, I hate to call her a kid because she's 25 and she's a legal adult,
mm-hmm.
but 25 is awfully young to be handling this kind of responsibility. You got to wonder how many years of experience she could have with shooting guns, let alone being accountable for everybody in a prop stage. And, you know, I would say that the very young child of a famous competition shooter who is working in Hollywood as a prop gun, I would normally not look, I would think twice about it, but I would certainly assume that they're going to be competent.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that this person was proven to be not competent makes me think that there's probably a heaping helping of nepotism going on here, you know, or maybe not nepotism is the wrong word, but certainly a heaping helping of capitalizing on her father's name.
Mm-hmm.
And it put her in a situation where she was unqualified to do the job, which is fine if you're, you know, the lighting guy or you're the sound guy and then the movie just sucks.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are accountable for ensuring that life or death weapons are safe, yeah, you don't lie on your resume and you don't overstate your qualifications and you be very, very careful to be humble and know your limits. So, like, let's just tally up the tremendous list of failures here. Number one, using live, fully functional firearms in a set where there absolutely did not need to be live, fully functional firearms. They should have all had barrel blocks installed and only be firing blanks. Number two, having live ammunition on in the area, even accessible to the people who were handling these guns. Because, by the way, doesn't California require you to have a firearms license to even buy ammunition?
I don't.
They have some kind of ammo control. I remember it was more difficult to get ammo control in California,
mm-hmm.
but that's a whole rabbit hole. Number three, having people take this firearm off of the set and use it for recreational shooting in the middle of the desert when you're filming. Number four, having a prop master who's not there holding, like, who's not taking care of this problem. And number five, and this is the worst one, willfully ignoring the voice concerns of a large number or at least a significant portion of the staff who said, this is unsafe and it's so unsafe, I'm going to walk off of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And then number six, this handgun was picked up and handed off by at least two people before getting into these actors' hands. And not one of them checked the firearm to make sure it was unloaded. And then number seven, violating all four rules of the gun safety. So we'll call that 7, 8, 9, and 10. Like, it's just, there's so many, so avoidable. So yeah, that's my executive summary. Pardon my French, weird, but there were
fudge
ups in multiple levels.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's worth doing a bleep. If there ever was something worth doing a bleep.
Yeah.
Is this disaster.
Well, let's keep the momentum going because
on to other cheery topics.
Yeah, this is so. Yeah, I did a bunch of interviews with Paloma, and this was one of the ones that she really wanted to talk about, which is she wanted to give us all at the Assorted Calibers podcast an update on the January 6th protest and what she has discovered with her usage of the Freedom of Information Act. I am very pleased to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast, lawyer Paloma Capanna. And Paloma, you gave us some great information on the events of the January 6th and some of the horrible treatment of the people that are being charged in that protest. Do you have any updates for us?
Just on that top line for sure, let's zero in that Jessica Watkins does remain in prison. She continues to be represented by attorney Michelle Peterson from the Federal Public Defender's Office. And I have actually now been dialing into status conferences and oral arguments and whatnot. If anybody else wants to do that, it's a really unique aspect of these cases. Just go to my Facebook page and it's 2A Law. So very simple, right? You go to Facebook and then /2A Law. L-A-W. And whenever there's court appearances upcoming, I post the dial-in phone number and extension, and you can call in. I'm really proud of Attorney Peterson. I think she's just doing an exceptional job of balancing in between some pretty difficult arguments and fighting to get justice for her client. So, you know, kudos. And if we're going to be legally blonde, snap for Michelle Peterson. But yes, Jessica Watkins remains in prison pending trial. The update that will be coming up later the month of October is the next status conference. All attorneys for all 16 of the 20 defendants need to let the judge know about trial dates. Right now, Jessica Watkins, Kelly Meggs, and Kenneth Harrelson, the three defendants who are in prison, are scheduled to begin trial January 31st of 2022. There is a discussion started to shift that trial date to April 19, and for the non-incarcerated defendant to flip their trial start date out to July. So do stay tuned. Judge Maida did an outstanding job at the last conference of pointing out to the attorneys who were saying, listen, we're not sure if we can be ready. Judge Maida took up the plight of the three incarcerated defendants saying, listen, even starting the trial in January, these people will have been in jail about a year and nobody's proven anything against them. So double snaps for Judge Maida for keeping in mind that these are real people who are in jail, and the United States Department of Justice at this point is on their sixth superseding indictment. They haven't proved a thing. Turning the corner slightly. What updates do I have in my quest for information on January 6th? I'm going to give you a totally new topic, Weird Beard.
All right.
And that is Freedom of Information Request. It is my favorite tool when I am not the attorney of record to send in the little letter to an officer or agency of the government and say, hey, I'd like the following records. You know, it's free. You can draft it yourself. You do not need to be an attorney. The officer agency is required to acknowledge your letter. They're required to respond to you in so many days. Depending their response, you've even got an appeal within the officer agency that is also free, and you simply can do it by sending in a letter within 30 days. From there, you're in federal court, and I regret to say my mini sabbatical might just be over because it looks like I'm going to have to file a federal lawsuit on behalf of myself against the United States Capitol Police, or USCP. On February 25th, 2021, Yogananda Pittman, the then acting chief of police for USCP, testified to Congress. And I do actually cover her testimony and that session of congressional testimony in my book that is currently out, The Events of January 6, 2021, What Impact the Second Amendment Movement. In her testimony, she gave a couple quotes that really startled me as an American. And she said, and I quote, "We have provided guidance to officers since January 6th as to when lethal force may be used consistent with the department's existing use of force policy." And she goes on to talk about how she is going to make it her mission to ensure that there is no confusion of her officers when they can use lethal force at any future such events. That chilled me as an American. That it, you know, I'm picturing the little yellow school buses, right, pulling up to the Capitol and kids piling out, and it's the school field trip, and, you know, wow, here we are at the Capitol, all excited. And as I dug a bit further into that statement and dug a bit further into the USCP, I came to realize just how militarized the USCP has become over the last so many years. And it's difficult to figure out where. Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? Is it 15 years? It seems possibly that issues began in 1998 when a lone gunman breached the Capitol. That may have been the starting point. Certainly the baseball field incident in 2017 with members of Congress being shot at. Certainly the woman in the car in 2013, right, driving into officers, behaving in an erratic manner. You know, her vehicle and her person took a total of 26 shots. Somehow the one-year-old in the back seat survived, and officers did say they didn't realize there was a kid in the car. When I started to look at USCP, I realized something very quickly that just struck me as an injustice. USCP has taken the position that it's not subject to FOIA. You can go on the internet and put in USCP and FOIA, and you're going to get a whole variety of different people on both sides of the aisle, and including the press, typing out the exact same letter that I received from USCP from James Joyce, their senior counsel. And it says, and I quote, "Please be advised that the United States Capitol Police, as a legislative branch entity, is not an agency as defined by 5 USC section 551. Okay. Anytime a lawyer is citing me to a statute, now that I'm in the January 6th realm, where lawyers from all kinds of places, including the DOJ, are claiming that statutes exist that don't exist the way they're quoting them, I do not rely on attorneys anymore. So instantly I go to this 5 USC section 551 and I look it up and it says, okay, the Congress itself is exempted from FOIA. In other words, I can't send a FOIA to Nancy Pelosi and ask for her personal emails back and forth with Liz Cheney going into appointments for the special commission. No, that is not covered by FOIA. There might be other ways to get at things, but that's not covered. But in my very basic Googling USCP FOIA, I got myself caught up with Judicial Watch and their current lawsuit against the USCP concerning Ashley Babbitt and January 6th. They did not go after USCP under FOIA. They went through a different route. They're having some success. But lo and behold, when USCP answered Judicial Watch's complaint this past summer, what do I read in the answer? The United States Capitol Police is an agency in the USCP's own paperwork. So I'm going back to my letter. Yes, James Joyce wrote, is not an agency to me, lawyer me, but to the court in the Judicial Watch case, they write, is an agency. So I think it's time to file a case to proceed to try to get the FOIA of what I'm looking for. What's my essential content? My essential, what I'm looking for, is what is the policy for the use of lethal force? If you, Yogananda Piven, are telling me, John Q. Public, that you have a policy, that you're training your officers, and that you are going to make darn sure that they know how to kill us in a similar circumstance, I'd like to know what that policy is. Number two, what types of firearms are you using? You talk about them in your testimony as assault weapons. Well, there's no such thing as an assault weapon. Then you talk about the protection of certain dignitaries on January 6th. Well, who is it that got the special treatment? I don't view this as particularly interesting FOIA questions. I had FOIA'd previously to the New York State Police. Mm-hmm. They sent me policy on use of lethal force. I go online and I Google policy on use of lethal force. First one that pops up happens to be the Department of Homeland Security of all agencies. That's the first one that came up. That's published on the internet. But USCP at more than $500 million a year budget, and after the killing of Ashley Babbitt, wants to remain a secret office or agency.
Is there any precedent to that, or it just doesn't make any sense to me?
There's as much precedent as we allow a wrongdoer to create. It's a bit of a sticky wicket. Sometimes you will have a case in court and you will lose, and you will say, okay, I'm not going to pursue the appeal to a higher court because I do not want to risk the higher court confirming the lower court. Something about my fact pattern didn't resonate as well with the court as I thought that it might. So I'm going to go sort of downfield a bit, if you will, bring in perhaps my backup quarterback. In other words, for me, a different plaintiff, a different scenario, a little bit of time later, and see if I get a better outcome. So, there's kind of that. But with USCP, Where I caught a bit of a lucky break is that Michael Bolton is now assigned at the head of OIG, so the Office of the Inspector General at the federal level. And Bolton is actually testifying to Congress for 2 days in June and issuing written reports. And in Bolton's reports, he's quoting from interviews of existing and former members of the USCP, including on the M4 being the long gun of choice and the Glock 22 being the handgun of choice. And among Bolton's findings is that the officers of the USCP are not being trained separately on the use of the M4 range, side note, 550 yards, and that they're essentially incompetent. I mean, is it fair to go to that space, right? He's definitely hinting that, if not using that exact word. And then it really had me rereading my original Freedom of Information request, which includes, you know, a few other things beyond the kind of top 3 points I'm covering right now. And I thought, you know what? We really do need this basic information. I myself, as an analyst, want to be able to compare USCP to other offices and agencies that I've looked at. I mean, I really do want to understand, where is the dividing line between the Secret Service, for example, and the USCP at events where the vice president is inside the Capitol? I'm doing some research into the history of these supposed statutes that DOJ has now cited, a couple really squishy subdivisions, that the Capitol grounds are closed to us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But if I go to the house.gov website, it says just stop by the gift store. You're welcome to come into the Capitol. You do not even need to leave your name in the guest book to be admitted. Well, how can all these conflicting things be true? They can't. They absolutely can't. And so my fear is that USCP, along with whatever fear is getting churned in the Congress before and after January 6th, is creating a culture that is at odds with what the law actually says. That is exactly the kind of situation that gets an activist caught in the crosshairs.
I mean, just the more we talk about the fallout from the events of January 6th, the more bonkers it gets.
I don't think that there's any question that my nickname is Alice in Wonderland. Because with every path that I follow that should logically take me to a very concrete place to be able to stand on terra firma and report, this is what I found. I don't find terra firma. What I find is tension. What I find is things that conflict directly with each other. Is USCP an agency? Not an agency. And to me, that's exactly the environment that is creating a hideous stress for just America in general and allowing people to say, oh, we're divided. Oh, we're fighting. Oh, this is terrible. We're so at odds with each other. Listen, I'm on this full time. And if I can't sort this out at a level, if you will, of evidence that is legally admissible, so basic rules of evidence in terms of competency of the speaker and the subject matter and so forth, how is the average person? How are you, sweet listeners of Assorted Calibers podcast, who have jobs and families and like a normal life that I would love to have and don't? How are you supposed to make decisions about your day, right? Can you order a book from me, or are you afraid that if you put that order through 2ampatriot.com that now the NSA knows? A, they shouldn't, and I have no reason to believe they do, but B, we shouldn't have to be thinking about this. So we've got to do some protecting of the First Amendment to protect the Second Amendment. It's kind of the play call that I'm at, you know, on my end as I monitor my 20 defendants, you know, who have been tagged up as quote unquote oath keepers. And now I try to pursue a little bit deeper some of what I've been reading and hearing in testimony to Congress, reading in court papers. And there's even one more rabbit hole I can take you down. If you're not feeling like too dizzy, grab a Diet Coke on ice, go down another rabbit hole with me.
Let's dive.
Okay. So, listeners, you may recall this fabulous show that Weird Beard and I did where we talked about a defendant named Thomas Caldwell. He was one of the very first defendants charged after January 6th. In papers to the court, Thomas Caldwell claimed, "I am not a member of the Oath Keepers. In fact, I am a former section chief of the FBI, and I spent my career in the Navy. And I've had multi-million dollar contracts with multiple government agencies, including the United States Department of Justice, who is prosecuting me now." Well, that made headlines. I am not the only person who noticed that, right? But as the news reports were rolling out, and as I comment in my book, I don't see anybody actually reaching out to the FBI to confirm, did he work for the FBI? So as I'm going through article after article, and I redid a search of this exact same thing 2 weeks ago, there is no reporter out there where I see an article that says, "And we contacted the FBI to verify this." Nope, don't see it. So what I did in August was I sent out a slew of Freedom of Information on Thomas Caldwell, including one to the FBI to say, "Hey, by the way, did the guy work for you?" Right? Because he's claiming he did. And that's kind of interesting. And would you let me know? So the FBI sends me this very long, incredibly verbal, like E.E. Cummings style letter that essentially says, "We can't tell you because that would be an invasion of his privacy." And in saying that would be an invasion of his privacy, we're not confirming that there are records that we're not disclosing. We're just trying to let you know we're not going to comment on it because that would be an invasion of his privacy. I'm not sure that was the answer I was expecting. I mean, I think a fact of whether somebody worked for the FBI or not, to me, is black and white. It's yes or no. He worked for you. He didn't work for you. There are records to support it or not. Yes, we're sending you redacted payroll records. No, we're not. Right? Or what I more expected, as a matter of national security, we can't respond, which I suppose to some degree then is yes. Right? He worked for us. That's kind of where I thought I'd end up on this thing, was a dead end, but not quite a dead end that is, let me tiptoe all around the issue, didn't quite work for me. That was the first one that came back. But then I started getting other responses, including from the Department of Justice, saying we had no contracts with Thomas Caldwell, and we had no contracts with his business either. And then the same letter came back from HUD. And this letter just kept coming from these agencies saying, "No, we have no records with Thomas Caldwell or his company in Virginia." And then the Navy got back to me and said, "We don't have a Thomas Caldwell with the service years that you've asked us about." And I took those years straight out of Thomas Caldwell's lawyer's papers. Now, I'm a fan of Ayn Rand. Who is John Galt? I hope your listeners understand the reference. Who is John Galt? Who is Thomas Caldwell? So I tried to think about this a little more creatively. I mean, really, my head is spinning. I'm thinking, this can't be. Why can't this be? Because I'm not all that smart, and I'm not actually a reporter. Why hasn't, like, somebody else gone after this? Is the other thing I'm thinking is, can I really be the only person in America who is, you know, speaking on a podcast or speaking to a newspaper that decided to try to check facts, right? I know the media, by definition these days, is a disappointment to everyone, but there's got to be somebody, right? So I go back into Thomas Caldwell's legal record. And when I say I go back, I mean, I don't want to tell you how much money I spent on PACER. PACER is the online legal system for the federal courts. Certain things are free. That's nice. PDF downloads. I love it. Certain things, though, you're paying. And even though it's only like 10 cents a page with a maximum charge, like for the size of any one document, let me tell you, it adds up, right? So I keep just hitting buy on PACER, buy on PACER, buy on PACER. I grab everything I can find, right? And I hit this one transcript where Thomas Caldwell is sitting in the courtroom with the judge who's going to decide, does he have to stay in jail pending trial or does he get released? Now, spoiler alert, he's released. So while Jessica Watkins and Kenneth Harrelson and Kelly Meggs battle it out in federal prison pending trial, Thomas Caldwell is out. The U.S. DOJ is so insulted when Thomas Caldwell gets released that they file motions to sort of bring him back in. The first judge stays his decision and pivots across to Judge Maida's courtroom, where the cases are now consolidated. And here now is Judge Maida with Thomas Caldwell and his second or third attorney sitting in the courtroom. What does Thomas Caldwell do? The entire hearing drives the judge nuts. You can sense it in the court transcript, because at first the judge is saying, Mr. Caldwell, you know, please be quiet. Mr. Caldwell, if you have something to say, please let your attorney know. Mr. Caldwell, you know, anything you say can be right used against you. Finally, the judge just starts ignoring him. Thomas Caldwell, in this hearing transcript, keeps uttering spontaneously one word, screenplay. Screenplay. One of Thomas Caldwell's attorneys in one of the submissions to the court had said, Judge, the guy's social media posts are just fiction. He was just making it all up. He's dying to write a screenplay to Hollywood. So I am sitting in my chair going, okay, is Thomas Caldwell an FBI provocateur, or is Thomas Caldwell a retired board guy, B-O-R-E-D, board, who thought, well, gun guys are cool. I'd like to hang out with them. How do I get to hang out with them? Oh, well, there's a MAGA rally. Oh, well, let me send Facebook messages, because in his Facebook and text and Parlay and all of these platforms, right? He's trying to entice people to set up a quick reaction force in Virginia that would be ready to cross the Potomac River to bring firearms to the Capitol if all hell breaks loose on January 6th. And I'm thinking to myself, there's got to be some way to figure out who the hell is Thomas Caldwell, because that's two pretty divergent explanations, right? I mean, that's not even close. I go into the transcripts again, and what do I see? I see Thomas Caldwell talking about the Blue Ridge Militia. Now, I'm in North Carolina right now as I'm standing here talking to y'all. Hear my y'all. I'm learning some Southern words like yes, and we be gone, right? So I think I'm going to call the Blue Ridge Militia just for the hell of it to see, did Thomas Caldwell in fact contact you? So I Google Blue Ridge Militia, and what do I come up with? You have to like make a drum roll or say, what did you come up with?
I am at the edge of my seat.
Thomas Caldwell plagiarized the Blue Ridge Militia out of a work of fiction. It doesn't exist.
That's why you didn't have a response from me. It's just one of those like, oh, I.
This is real life.
This so is real
Thomas
life.
Thomas Caldwell, in communicating with people like Jessica Watkins, fed them a line of
sugar.
And I don't know if I can say that on your podcast, but if not, you can edit that out. I give you permission to do the beep. That's fine. I'm an attorney, 25 years in courtrooms. I am eloquent. I win awards for my writing. I kid you not, including two book awards for my collection of essays. That's what it comes down to, is Thomas Caldwell's recklessness in communicating with people like Jessica Watkins has them in jail and facing more than 30 years in federal prison and fines exceeding $850,000 because the guy wanted to write a screenplay. Now, there's still an opportunity here for the FBI to redeem Thomas Caldwell. So think about how bizarre that is, right? That the better outcome here is that somebody actually steps forward and says, yes, Thomas Caldwell did work for the FBI. He was working for the FBI going into January 6th. And he also worked on the Michigan governor kidnapping case. Right? Because honestly, Weird Beard, if it's true that everything Thomas Caldwell said was a lie, shame on you. Shame on you. How dare you come into the middle of American politics at such a tense moment in the history of this country in a fight between Trump and Biden, with so much on the line, including look at what has happened since, and I'm only going to reference Afghanistan because who needs a second example when you've got that pullout to point to? And you just thought you'd play around and try to write a screenplay out of a gig? That's my tragic update thus far. And listen, I'm not telling you I have the definite answer. I'm telling you my current hypothesis is that the guy was just using us and full of lies.
I'm going to find the words and pick my jaw up off the floor and thank you so much for coming on the Assorted Calibers podcast. Thank you so much, Paloma Capanga.
Thank you, Weird Beard, and everybody who's tuning in and who is committed to justice and the Second Amendment.
Yeah, so first off, I didn't realize it was so easy to file a Freedom of Information Act request. I might have to do one just for funsies.
Yeah, I've always wanted, like, I may look into it as well on the, like, the one that I've always wanted to do, which is just get the evidence seized at the Virginia Tech shooting. It's gotten so old that it kind of doesn't seem like much, but I've heard conflicting reports at whether or not he had full-size magazines or 10-round limited magazines. I believe that was done with entirely 10-round limited magazines as far as the Glock 8/19 used in that shooting was. I wanted to know.
Virginia Tech was, he had two handguns, and one of them, wasn't it like a Walther P-22 or something?
One was a Walther P-22. They only make 10-round magazines for that, yep. So that's for sure. But the other one was a Glock 19, and he bought the Glock 19 from a local gun store, and one would assume that unless it was some weird, like, California-compliant gun that made its way into Virginia, it came with two 15-round magazines. And then he bought the remainder of his magazines on eBay, which... after that, dumped all, I think, gun supplies in general, or I can't remember what, but definitely magazines you can no longer buy on eBay.
Yeah.
But the statement was that they had a policy that you could only sell 10-round magazines on eBay. So in theory, yep, the Glock 19 magazines that he purchased would be the 10-round limited magazines.
Well, and I usually don't bother really learning more about the specific firearm involved, except in this case, because it was, like, you know, it was California compliant, more or less, or if not California compliant, it was limited capacity magazines. It's what people are pushing for.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still the most lethal shooting up until that point, and was the most lethal shooting until, I think, Pulse. It was up there. It held that record for a good while. And
I was going to say, I think Sandy Hook was before Pulse anyway.
Okay. Then it might've been Sandy Hook was worse than, yeah, it was the worst one.
And I wasn't counting the same because I usually see it as, not spree shootings in general, but school shootings. So
yeah,
I'm not 100% sure.
Well, and the other one I remember is, I don't recall his name, and even if I knew it, I wouldn't say it. The jerk who was the incel guy.
Oh yes, the Buena Vista. It was Santa Barbara. Yeah,
the incel guy who posted some social media video about, you know, about how women had mistreated him right before he went on a shooting spree. He had like a car full of 10-round magazines, if I recall. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Anyways,
and he did, I mean, half the kills he did with either a knife or his car as well. So,
yeah. But anyways, this whole January 6th thing is just a mess. It's become so politicized, and it surprises me that people that I know don't see how politicized it's become. Like, people that I know that are kind of like centrist ish or lean maybe a little bit left, They still think of this as like this terrible assault on democracy that, you know, like, yes, it was incredibly dumb, and, you know, it was you don't do that kind of thing. But I mean, I don't look at it as the attention in the prosecution is all out of proportion to the actual event. Mm-hmm. And there are so many other events that were worse, like the actual attempted arson of an occupied courthouse in Portland, that are not getting the how many people got prosecuted for that? It can't have been a lot.
And what was worse is they were all out on bail the next day, no matter what. These people were arrested or in some cases turned themselves in. And now it's been almost 10 months now.
Yeah.
And they haven't even been, you know, had their day in court.
You know, I can't help but wonder if this is where we're seeing the chickens come home to roost with the whole, you know, Patriot Act and just the tools that we created and that we enabled, that we told ourselves were only going to be used on the bad guys, they're only going to be used on the terrorists. Those same apparatus are now able to be used against American citizens. You know, this is surveillance like the NSA. This is the ability to just kind of take almost a political prisoner. And, you know, I'm not nearly as educated as Paloma is on this, obviously, and I'm probably less educated than your average listener of the podcast on this, but I just, I look at this and I wonder, I wonder what's going to happen in the future that is going to get this same kind of response where people just kind of lose their legal rights without any effective recourse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course the mystery people, I mean, I just don't even know where to go through it. I don't know if Paloma's figured out what this guy's story is.
Remind me, are we talking about the, like five guys with crew cuts and big watches?
No,
anniversary protest.
No, talking about the guy who claims to be part of the FBI and the Navy, wasn't in either, claims to be part of a militia that's made up.
Oh yeah.
And all that. And that's certainly one thing that pops into my mind with all of these instances of officers going undercover to stop terrorist plots and pretty much being the only people there.
Yeah. Well, and they're definitely pushing the whole militia angle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've been seeing some pretty ridiculous headlines about the Oath Keepers. You know, it's like they act like they just came out of nowhere and they're some kind of crazy anti-government extremist. But the funny thing is the oath that they're talking about keeping is the oath to defend the United States. You know, it's just crazy how politicized this has become.
Mm-hmm. Well,
oof. Well, this was a cheery one.
Yeah, we could call that good.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it good. I would call it complete.
Yes.
Well, you know what? This is what happens when you're not here. It just gets all depressing.
So, yeah, but what's not depressing is all of our listeners. I mean, it would be depressing if we were just talking and none of y'all listened. And so, thank you all to every one of our listeners, but also we have supporters on Patreon. They get early releases of the podcast. They get other bonus content like blooper reels. They get the ACP mag dump, and we've got the ACP film track. I'm trying to do the math. I think it's already just come out, but we're going to have the film track for Jaws just in time for Halloween.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, that is a classic horror, and one of the best movies ever made. Go ahead and check out patreon.com/Sword Calibers podcast and check it out. See if you want some stuff. It's a lot of good stuff. Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts. You can also subscribe to us on the platform of your choice and share it with, you know, people, you know, let people know. If you like this show, let other people know you like it. And you can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworlds.com. And I'm also on Handgun Radio. And of course, Erin Paulette. She's still with us. She's at Operation Blazing Sword and Pink Pistols. She also does blue collar prepping, and she's got her blog called Lurking Rhythmically.
And you can get more from me here, because this is the only place I am. And Erin usually does the outros, but she's not here, so you gotta deal with me. The quality of the outros is assorted, and so is the podcast. Did I do that right?
I think that's pretty good. And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music. Oh, good night, everybody.
Good night.